Also, I think this is the latest of all the 181 sections I've taught. I think this is the latest in the term where we still have 24 students. So, congratulate yourselves. Anyway, importantly, everything I say on this recording today is important for upstairs and here. Okay, this is lecture material and lab material. Eventually, I'll be giving you three slides from a chapter we haven't gotten to yet because it relates to today. Just realize you have to know that stuff for the exam as well as for the quiz. All right, today we want to talk about transport processes that can bring things into a cell or take things out of a cell. And there's three major categories of such transport processes. Anyone have any idea what the three are? Yeah. Osmosis is a specific example of one of the categories. Same thing. It's just a specific example of one of the categories. Passive transport is one, yes. What's another? Active transport. And you might think that's it. But there is a third, which is vesicular transport. We'll talk more about vesicular transport upstairs, but it's named for the fact that it involves the formation of a vesicle, which is a little bag made out of membrane. All right. Now let's focus on these other two. Passive and active transport are distinguished on the basis of energy, but I don't want you to think that passive transport doesn't require any energy. That's wrong. You can't transport anything for free. It requires energy to move things. Okay? But passive transport does not require an additional expenditure of energy because the energy required for the passive transport is already built into the system, which I'll explain a little bit more in a minute. For active transport, you have to supply additional energy. Otherwise, it's not going to occur. And we'll be talking more about active transport upstairs later, too. But that's the difference between active and passive transport. Passive transport does require energy, but the energy is already built in. You don't have to add it from outside. And that's really what we're talking about today. Everything else for today is about passive transport. Now, passive transport occurs because of the existence of a gradient. Gradient is a pretty general term. There's all kinds of different kinds of gradients. But a gradient, in general, is a difference. It's a difference in the value of something at one place compared to another place. So, for instance, the reason that you have a sensation of cold when you put ice cubes in your hand is that there's a temperature gradient, a difference in temperature at your skin compared to the ice. The reason that the water comes out of the faucet is because of a pressure gradient. Pressure is higher inside the pipe than outside. Those are examples of gradients. So the gradient itself is just the difference. What you're measuring determines what kind of gradient it is. Pressure gradient, electrochemical gradient. There's a gradient of electrical charge between the two electrodes when you plug in something in the in an AC outlet. Another name that we give for a gradient of electrical charge or electrical potential is voltage. Voltage is a gradient. Those are all examples, but today we're going to be talking about concentration gradients. A concentration gradient is a difference in the concentration of something at one place, point A, compared to point B. All right, so the gradient is the difference itself. Regardless of what type of gradient it is, it's important, and I'll keep saying this over and over upstairs, to keep in mind that any sort of gradient is a source of potential energy, which means that a gradient has the potential or the capacity to do some work. And this is what I meant earlier when I said it's not true that passive transport doesn't require any energy. It takes energy to move things from one place to another. But the source of energy in passive transport is the gradient itself. That's an example of a gradient doing some work. Okay? Now, all particles, whether it's particles in a gas or in a solid or a liquid, but today we're dealing with liquids, all particles in that population of particles are moving, but they're moving independently. Each one is moving at any given moment in time at its own speed and in its own direction. So they're not all moving at the same speed, but there is an average speed, right? Which is what temperature is all about. Each particle, though, could be going fast or slow or anything in between and at some specific direction until it hits something. It's a random movement of particles, and that random movement of particles is called Brownian motion. Now, passive transport is diffusion. Diffusion is the transport of particles down a concentration gradient. And when I say down a gradient, what I mean is that it's movement of particles from whichever place of the two has the higher concentration of those particles toward whichever place of the two has the lower concentration. So diffusion happens from high concentration to low concentration. In other words, diffusion is a directed process. You can tell which direction it's going to work in if you know the concentrations. Always goes down the gradient, not up. All right? But it's kind of paradoxical or self-contradictory that, or it seems like it at least, it's not really. What seems like a paradox, though, is that diffusion, passive transport, is a directed process that occurs because of random motion. The random motion is the Brownian motion I talked about. Those particles individually are not going one direction or another. They're just going whatever random direction that particle is traveling in. But as a population, by diffusion, those particles are going to move in one direction more so than another, specifically in the direction toward the lower concentration. Now, how can this be that random motion causes directed mass movement? Well, let's just imagine a container with some particles in it. And I'll just draw a few. If those particles are concentrated, they're all packed together with a lot of space around that chunk, then there is going to be diffusion, even though it's because of random motion. And here's why. Think about the particles that are deep inside that group. They're not at the surface, in other words, of that group. They're all, each of those in the inner core of that are moving independently in different directions. But each individual particle is only going to move in a straight line until it hits something and bounces off of it. So all these ones in the middle aren't going to get very far before they bounce, because they're going to hit other particles. Okay, now think about the periphery, which is the edge, the particles that make up that outer edge. Some of those particles aren't going to get very far either, because even though they're on the edge, some of them are going to be traveling toward the inner. Right? So they're going to bounce as well. But some of those ones on the edge, randomly, are going to be moving in a direction that sends them away from the crowd. Right? And when that happens, now you have fewer ones that are compacted together. And you've made room for a new surface, some of which are going to be able to leave if they're going in the right direction. So over time, this will get spread out throughout the entire container. You come back later, there won't be a high concentration here and a low concentration everywhere else. It will be the same concentration everywhere in the container. This random motion causes it, but it happens in a directed way from high concentration to low concentration. All right? That's passive transport or diffusion. Now, what I've just described here, and you could easily do this in real life by plunking a sugar cube into a glass of water. You have two kinds of particles, right? Water molecules and sugar molecules. But right at first, before you let it sit, you're going to have a very high concentration of sugar where the cube is, very low concentration of sugar everywhere else. And so the sugar, over time, is going to spread out from where it is originally, because it's allowed to move, right? That is simple diffusion, because there's no barrier that the particle is going through. Okay, it's passive transport, but we use the word simple if it's not going through any barrier like a membrane. That will happen only if, or I should say, passive transport will happen only if two conditions are met. Two things have to be true for diffusion to occur. One is that there has to be, and by diffusion I mean net diffusion. Net diffusion refers to movement in one overall direction, from high concentration to low concentration. That will occur only if, number one, there is a gradient. Zero gradient would mean there is no gradient. If point A and point B have the same concentration, then there's no gradient. And there won't be any movement from A to B more than B to A. No net diffusion. So that's one requirement, but that's not enough. The other requirement is for there to be diffusion from A to B, is for there to be a way for the particle, whatever it is, to get from A to B. So the gradient is the tendency for it to happen. The gradient puts into play the tendency for that particle, in a sense it wants to go from A to B, from high concentration to low concentration. But if something blocks it, it, of course, is not going to be able to do that. So you have to have also a way to get from A to B. And in the sugar, in water example, there's nothing blocking it. So it diffuses. Both conditions are met. By the way, water also diffuses in that example, in the opposite direction, but it's still going down its own gradient. Because when you first put the sugar cube in there, you have a high concentration of water around it, around the sugar cube, and a low concentration where the cube is. So water's going to spread out to where the sugar is. That's going down its own gradient. You see that? Simple diffusion. No membranes involved. Okay. Sometimes, though, there are membranes between A, a membrane between A and B. And this is exactly the situation for a cell, because every cell by definition has a membrane, right? The plasma membrane. And that membrane is a barrier between two aqueous solutions. The intracellular fluid is one solution. The extracellular fluid outside the cell is another solution. And so the A and B could be the inside the cell and outside the cell. Okay, now let's look at some pictures. Like I said before, we haven't gotten to this chapter yet, but once we do get to this chapter, I'll just skip over these three slides I'm going to give you now, because by then you'll already have had this information. So it's good that I'm doing it down here, not only because it's related to today, but because I wouldn't even be able to fit this all into the time I have upstairs. Anyway, though, whatever these orange molecules of dye represent, they are particles. And this box, you see three boxes at the top, it's the same box in different points in time. So you're starting here with one overall compartment, but notice the gray dashed line. That represents a membrane compartmentalizing the main compartment into two subcompartments, left side and right side. And not only is it a membrane, but it's a membrane that allows certain things to pass through it and certain other things not to pass through it, which we describe as a phrase as being selectively permeable. To permeate means to go through. Selectively permeable means some things get through and others don't. It depends on the particle. Well, in this case, the orange dye molecules are permeable through the membrane. The membrane is permeable to the orange dye molecules. And notice that at first, on the left, there is a concentration gradient in place, because there is a difference in concentration of orange molecules on the left compared to the right. There's a high concentration on the left, a low concentration, zero to start with, on the right. So that's the tendency. The gradient itself is the tendency for diffusion to occur. That's what's going to drive it. But also, there's a way for it to get from A to B, from left to right, because the membrane allows this particular type of particle through it. So if you let this thing go for a while, that's exactly what happens. It's not that all of the dye molecules are going to move from left to right. They're moving randomly. But when there's none on the right yet, all of the movement at the beginning is going to go from left to right, because that's the only possibility, right? Once you have some in the right-hand case, on the right-hand side, some of them are randomly going to go back to the left. But whichever one you have, whichever side you have more of in, it's more likely that they're going to go from there to the other side. That's what causes the diffusion. And if you let this run for a long time, you finally come to equilibrium, which is the situation in this case in which there is no gradient remaining. Because the two sides have equal concentrations. The gradient, in other words, is zero. There's no more tendency for diffusion in one direction more than the other. That does not mean the particles stop, right? They're still moving. But at equilibrium, there's just as much left to right movement as there is right to left movement. So there is no more net diffusion, even though there's still movement of particles. Is that all clear? On the bottom is the same exact situation, only using two different particle types: orange dye and purple dye. And the important point here is that if you have a collection with different types of particles, which you do by definition in a solution, right? Solution has different kinds of particles in it. Then, importantly, every different type of particle has and obeys its own kind of gradient. And the gradient for one type of particle does not determine the movement of any other kind of particle. Each individual particle is moving simply because of its own gradient. The gradients are independent of each other. So orange dye molecules are moving toward the right simply because there is a gradient of orange dye in that direction. Orange is going from high to low. That doesn't affect purple. Purple's going from right to left simply because it's obeying its own purple gradient. It's still going down its gradient, right, from high to low, but it's in the opposite direction because of how they were arranged to begin with. And this can come to equilibrium as well. In which case, there's two gradients still, but when it comes to equilibrium, each of the two gradients is at zero. So no more net diffusion. Any questions on that? That is not only diffusion, but it's diffusion through a membrane. Okay. Then let's go to a special case of diffusion. What we're going to look at now is osmosis. And this is, by a lot of textbooks, in my opinion, described confusingly as far as language is concerned. It seems like it's a backwards definition. Let me give you a typical textbook definition of diffusion, and then I'll tell you the problems that I have with that. A lot of textbooks will say something, biology textbooks will say something like, osmosis is the movement of water from a place of low solute concentration to a place of high solute concentration. Have you ever read this? That's almost true, but it's, despite it being almost true, it's confusingly written, I think. One problem is that osmosis does not have to be movement of water. A biology textbook will always say water because in biological cases, the solvent is always water. But osmosis is diffusion of solvent rather than solute. So in chemistry, it could be something other than water. Okay? That's one problem with that definition. But the bigger problem is how they word the rest of the definition. If they say it's movement of solvent from low solute concentration to high solute concentration, it makes it sound like it is an exception to diffusion, which I told you is always from high to low concentration. Well, it's not actually an exception. It's just that they backwardly worded this. Think about what it means for there to be low solute concentration. That means there's a lot of solvent, right? It's watery. If it's the salt water, for instance, low solute concentration would mean high water concentration. Yeah.
Like going off of the example you gave earlier.
Yeah.
For the sugar cube, while the sugar is dissolving and going into diffusion, what does that mean? Well, you're explaining, it kind of sounds like osmosis, the process of water going into the sugar cube.
No, that's just simple diffusion of water. And I was going to explain this, why that's true anyway. I'm getting there.
Okay. All right.
But low solute concentration means, it's just a backwards way of saying high solvent concentration, right? So water, even though it's a solvent, still has its own gradient. All right? Water has its own gradient because water is its own type of particle. And so water can diffuse down that gradient if a gradient exists. Just like any other kind of particle, water is, if it's going to diffuse, it's going to diffuse in a net direction from where there's higher water concentration to where there's lower water concentration, which is the same thing as saying from low solute concentration to high solute concentration, except that it more directly expresses it. Yeah.
So is osmosis just solvent going down to concentration?
No. The reason that the sugar cube example is not osmosis, even though water is moving, is because osmosis is not just diffusion of solvent. It's more than that. It has to be solvent, first of all, to be osmosis. But also, for it to be osmosis, the solvent, which is water in biology, has to be moving through a selectively permeable membrane. And there is no membrane involved in that sugar cube example. So that was just diffusion of water. Okay? If you have a membrane, though, through which water can get, but other types of particles can't, it's because it's a selectively permeable membrane, and water ends up going down its gradient through that membrane, then it's osmosis. It's important, though, to realize that osmosis is simply a special case of diffusion. All osmosis is diffusion. Not all diffusion is osmosis. Is that clear? Well, then let's look at the picture. Here you have what was originally meant by the phrase YouTube before the website, a glass tube formed in a U, basic laboratory glassware. And on the bottom of the U is a selectively permeable membrane. Water can get through that, but whatever the green particles are, cannot. Okay, once again, you have the same tube just before and after. On the left, at first, notice that the two sides of the U featured solutions of different concentration. It's the same kind of solution because it's water and green particles in both, but the concentration is different. It's a low concentration on the left of solutes, a high concentration of solutes on the right. But here's what I was talking about before. Low solute concentration means high solvent concentration, and vice versa. Now, these are two different kinds of particles. So as I said before, there are two gradients here, not one. Water particles have their own gradient. Green particles have their own gradient. And if the gradient is not zero, then that type of particle has the tendency to diffuse. But remember, you have to also have the ability to diffuse, to get from A to B. Green doesn't have that ability. So the green particles would like to diffuse from right to left, down their own gradient. They're just blocked, so they're not going to. Water has the tendency, the gradient, and it has the ability. So water will diffuse, and since it's going through a selectively permeable membrane, we call that diffusion osmosis. And it's going down its own gradient from more watery to less watery. High water concentration to low water concentration. Osmosis always, if it happens at all, it always happens in the direction to the less watery place. Water is going to where it's less watery. Yeah. Reverse osmosis, the process to purify the water is to squeeze it so it goes against its gradient and therefore purifies the water by leaving only water behind. It's using pressure to do that. It doesn't happen on its own. So that's not a passive process in that case. You're reversing osmosis, so you're forcing it to move in the opposite direction that it wants to. And you have to supply energy to do that. So it's active, actually. This is passive, though. Osmosis is diffusion. All diffusion is passive. So osmosis is a passive process, just like diffusion is. Okay? Now, before we looked at equilibrium happening when the gradients came to zero, right? Well, it looks like the gradients come to zero here as well. Because the more water that leaves the left side down the gradient to go to the right side, the more you're depleting the left side of water, and therefore the volume on the left side goes down, and the volume goes up on the right side. So you're diluting the right side by adding more water from the left side, and you're making the concentration of solutes more strong as you remove water. Eventually, the solute concentration will be the same on both sides if that happens, right? And therefore the water concentration will be the same as well. So the gradients did come to zero in this case, and you would expect that to be equilibrium. Still movement of water, but just as much right to left as left to right movement. No net movement, in other words, in one direction. All right, but I want you to, I don't have a picture of this next one, but I want you to imagine the same exact setup, except you start with no solute particles in the left. You still have the same on the right, but just pure water on the left. Okay, there's still a gradient for water, right? There's both gradients are in place, but the particle, the green particles can't move despite their gradient. The water has an even stronger gradient because it's higher concentration in pure water. So they want to go to the right. But if you start with pure water, it doesn't matter how much water moves to the right, you're still going to have pure water on the left. And even though you're diluting the right, it's still going to be a higher than zero concentration of solutes when you add more and more water to it, right? You're not going to make it pure water over here. So there would always be a gradient for water, no matter how much gets removed. It would still come to equilibrium, though, even though there's gradients in place. And that's because as you make this left, as you deplete the left side and make the right column taller, the right column gets heavier and heavier, being pulled down by gravity. And when the force of gravity exactly equals the opposing force of osmosis, then it will come to equilibrium, even though there's still gradients in place. Okay. And as a matter of fact, if you used a plunger, you could force it back. That's reverse osmosis. Now, that is osmosis as a topic. Let's go to slide 12, which is the last of the slides I'll give you, and talk about tonicity. This is more confusing terminology. Tonicity refers to the tendency for osmosis to occur either into or out of a cell. All right. So it could be water is entering a cell, it could be it's leaving a cell. The tendency for that to occur is in general called tonicity, but there are different degrees and directions of tonicity, which you can see at the top of these columns on the slide. Solutions can be either hypotonic, isotonic, or hypertonic. Now, before I define those, I want to warn you about the lab manual, which has various errors in it because I didn't write it. So it tells you some things that are wrong. And I want you to obey me, not what it says in the manual. One thing that it gets wrong is the use of these words. None of these three words, hypotonic, hypertonic, isotonic, should ever be used to describe a cell. These words should only be used to describe the surroundings, the outside of the cell, the solution outside of the cell, the solution the cell is bathed in. All right? So beware of that when you're reading the manual. She gets that wrong. Okay, now I said that tonicity is tendency for osmosis to occur, and osmosis is movement of solvent, not solute, right? It's the water, not the solute particles that are moving in osmosis. And this is why these terms are confusing, because they seem to be defined backwards as well. These words are based not on water's concentration, but on solute concentration, even though the only concentration that matters, the only gradient that matters, is the water gradient. Water obeys the water gradient only. But these words actually describe what's happening to the solutes. And that's why it seems backwards. Hypo, as a general prefix, means what? Means what? Not exactly less, no. It means below, like hypodermic, below the skin, right? And hyper means above, hyperactive, for instance. Iso means same. Okay, here's the backwards part. These prefixes really aren't talking about water. They're talking about solutes, even though water is what matters. Hypotonic is a word that describes a solution that has a lower, that's where the hypo comes from, a lower concentration of solutes than the cell's intracellular fluid does. Right? There's two different solutions when you have a cell in an environment. You have extracellular fluid, that's one solution. You have intracellular fluid, that's the other solution. The only thing that you apply these words to is the extracellular fluid. That's what you're describing with these words, not the cell. But a hypotonic solution is one that has a lower overall solute concentration than the cell does. That's what makes it seem confusing. That's a backwards way of saying that a hypotonic solution has a higher water concentration than the cell does. Okay? Because if there's lower solute concentration, it means it's more watery than the cell. And which direction does osmosis always occur in? Toward the less watery place. So if a cell is in a hypotonic solution, which is more watery than the cell, because it has a lower solute concentration than the cell, that means water is always going to move down its gradient into the cell. It's moving to where it's less watery inside the cell. Exactly the opposite for a hypertonic solution. The hyper, meaning above, refers to the solutes. A hypertonic solution is one that has a higher solute concentration than the cell. That's a backwards way of saying that a hypertonic solution is less watery than the cell. Well, it's still the same case that water, if there is a gradient, is going to move to the less watery place. But in this case, the less watery place is outside of the cell. So water leaves the cell if the cell is in a hypertonic solution. Now, we have two rows for here, three columns, but two rows. One row shows you what happens to a typical animal cell, like this erythrocyte or red blood cell. You already know some differences between animals and well, maybe you don't. We haven't really gotten there in lecture. But animal cells, like all cells, have plasma membrane. It's not a cell if it doesn't have a plasma membrane. A plant cell also has a plasma membrane, but unlike an animal cell, a plant cell has a much thicker and more rigid cell wall exterior to that plasma membrane. And that's important when tonicity comes into play. The animal cell, the red blood cell, in a hypotonic solution does not do well, because the water coming in, by going down its gradient to where it's less watery in the cell, is going to stretch that thin, flimsy plasma membrane, maybe to the point that it bursts, the cell bursts. A cell bursting is the end of the life of that cell. So it's bad for it, in other words. And that bursting is called lysis. This is the past tense verb, lysed. But lysis, just like in hydrolysis, means splitting. So lysis is the bursting of an animal cell in a hypotonic environment because of the inrush of water osmotically. A plant cell, on the other hand, does best in a hypotonic environment. It's still the same from the viewpoint of water. Water's going to where it's less watery, so it's going into the plant cell. But because that plant cell has a much more thick and rigid cell wall, it will hold the pressure. And it doesn't burst. It makes it swollen or turgid. That makes that individual cell happy, but it also makes the overall plant happy. Because the plant will have an erection, similar to an erection of a penis, only the pressure in a penis is from blood pressure. But if you have many plant cells, each of which are taking in water because you give it pure water when you water it, that's a hypotonic solution. You can't get more watery than pure water. It's maximally hypotonic. So the water goes into the cells. Each one individually swells. But since they're right next to each other, they all push on each other. And that's why a green stem that doesn't have any, you know, stiff woody structures in it like a tree does will still stand up straight. That's a healthy plant. And you can tell it's time to water it because it'll get limp again. Okay? So plant cells do best in a hypotonic environment. Animal cells, no. Let's go to the other extreme, hypertonic. If you put an animal cell in a hypertonic environment, it will lose water, and therefore the volume goes down, and therefore it will shrivel. And that shriveling of an animal cell in a hypertonic environment gets its own name, which is called crenation. That's an N, not M, like in cremation. Okay, crenation is bad for the cell too. It will kill it if it's severe enough. So lysis, one extreme kills it. Crenation for hypotonicity will also kill it, an animal cell. A plant put into a hypertonic environment will lose water for the same reason. But it does not undergo crenation. There's a different word for it because of that cell wall. The cell wall will hold its shape. The cell wall, by the way, is like the structure of the wall of this room, the thickness of it. The paint is like the plasma membrane inside on the inner surface of that cell wall. And when you lose water, the water is all inside the plasma membrane. When you take all that out, or a lot of it, in a hypertonic environment, that cell, that plasma membrane is going to peel away from the cell wall. That's what's happening here. And that will kill the plant cell. That peeling away is called plasmolysis. Now be careful with this word because it ends in lysis, but it's exactly the opposite of environmentally. A plant cell will undergo plasmolysis in a hypertonic environment, which is the plant version of crenation, by losing water. An animal cell will undergo lysis in a hypotonic environment. Now, a plant can survive an isotonic solution, which is, by definition, a solution that has the same overall solute concentration as the cell does, which is a more complicated way of saying that an isotonic solution is just as watery as the cell. So there is no water gradient, and therefore no tendency for water to go inside more than outside. They'll both happen at the same time, and there won't be a change in volume of the cell. But even though the plant cell survives it, it makes that a limp or flaccid cell. And that's when you see the stem sagging if you forget to water the house plant. And if you get it in time, it can go back to turgid. It can get another erection and make it stand up. So plants survive isotonicity, but it's not ideal for them. It is, on the other hand, ideal for an animal cell because it doesn't cause lysis, since more water isn't coming in than is leaving, and it doesn't cause crenation, since it's not the case that more water is leaving than is entering. Instead, equal amounts are coming in and out, and the volume stays nice and perfect for that animal cell. And a big part of homeostasis in your body is maintaining your concentrations of your fluids within allowable limits so that your cells don't burst or crenate. Okay? Any questions on all of that? Well, those are the three slides, but I'm not done yet because I have to talk about specifically this experiment. This is going to be the second report, and it has its own set of instructions in the manual, just like the first one did. It's probably best, and I probably don't have to tell you this, because most of you probably will wait until closer to the due date, but it's probably good to not even write this until after you have done, after the grading is done for the first one. Okay? Just pay attention to the due date, which is already listed on Canvas. I want to talk about the graph, though. You graph dependent and independent variable. Which one goes on the x-axis? Independent variable. And what is that today? Concentration of the solution. Yes. What kind of solution is it? What's the solute? Sucrose, table sugar. Now, technically one of them isn't a solution because it's pure water, right? So you have a zero molar. What is it? A 0.3 molar and a 0.5 molar? Okay. So, once again, do not give me this. 0.3, 0.5, equally spaced. Those numbers are not equally spaced on a number line, right? Use a true numeric axis. Space them correctly. And that's a big deal because that's going to affect your line of best fit. But, what's the dependent variable? Yes, I'm glad you said change in mass. Now, I think the manual gets this wrong, too. They call it weight. It's really mass that you're reporting, right? Grams are mass. So, but importantly, don't on the y-axis give me mass. Give me change in mass. What is the symbol in science that we use for a change in something? Delta. Right, so delta mass, like any delta calculation, is a difference. Well, there's two ways that you could compute a difference, right? A minus B or B minus A. Well, in a delta, which is A is before and B is after, what is the correct way of doing this? Well, delta mass is mass final minus mass initial. That's important for this reason. If the final mass, what you weigh after I'm done talking, is greater than your initial mass, then what's that going to make delta mass? What kind of number? If you have larger minus smaller, it's going to be a positive number. But if initial mass is greater, then when you subtract greater from smaller, you're going to get a negative number, right? Those signs are important. A positive delta mass, a positive change in mass, means water was gained. A negative change in mass means water was lost. So you not only have to get the magnitude right, the numbers, you have to get the sign right. Do it this way. And so what I was saying is don't plot the mass. Plot the change in mass, which requires two weighings to calculate. All right. So you have three data, really, from all of this today. Well, six raw data. Three initial masses, three final masses, and those will allow you to calculate three delta masses or changes in mass. And so there's going to be three dots on your graph. One for 0, one for 0.3, and one for 0.5. Okay, now to the part that confuses the most people. And it confuses so many people that I'm just going to tell you how to do it. And even then, about half of you are not going to do it this way. Maybe because you're not going to listen to this recording again before you do your report. But one of the questions in the report instructions asks you to determine, this is the goal of the entire experiment, to determine the solute concentration inside the potato cell. Well, you're not measuring that directly, right? You're not getting in the cell, counting number of solute particles, and then dividing by the total amount of liquid inside that cell. That's what the concentration is, right? You can't do that. So you can't answer the question unless you have a way of indirectly determining that, which is what the experiment's all about. All right? And that's where you have to rely on the definitions of tonicity that I gave you, the 3 degrees of tonicity. So let's just say, I'm just going to put some fake dots here. Let's say these are your 3 dots. I should put it like this because these two are closer together than this, right, on the numeric scale. They don't line up perfectly. That shouldn't surprise you for real data, but it looks like they're pretty linear, right? So you could draw a line of best fit. I'm just going to roughly do it. Now, this is change in mass on this side, right? A change can be a positive number, zero, or a negative number. So don't put your zero down here like you're used to doing on graphs. The zero is somewhere in the middle. Let's say it's right there. You have positive numbers up here, negative numbers down there. Because if you carefully did things the way I told you to, you probably should get some measurements that are negative, some that are positive. And you won't do that. If you plot mass rather than change in mass, they'll all be positive. Has to be change in mass. Okay. Now, back to this question. What is the solute concentration in the cell? Well, what is the definition of an isotonic solution that I just gave you? Say it louder.
Water outside and inside.
Well, the definition of isotonicity is that it's a solution that has the same overall solute concentration as the cell has. So if you know what the concentration of an isotonic solution is, by definition of isotonicity, you also know the concentration of the cell. You following me on that? Okay, now, how would you determine an isotonic solution's concentration with the graph? Well, if you get lucky and you have zero change in mass on your two measurements for one of your trays, then that would be isotonic by definition, right? But chances are much greater that none of them is going to be a zero change. Two of them will either be positive and one's negative, or two will be negative and one's positive. One or the other, probably. Okay, but that doesn't mean you can't use interpolation to figure out what the concentration would be for isotonic. What does it functionally mean in the experiment for it to be isotonic? If you actually did have a truly isotonic solution rather than the three you're using, what would be the change in mass? Zero. And so you use your line of best fit to figure out, by going from zero straight over to the line, what the concentration on the x-axis would be. And whatever that concentration is would have to be the same concentration as in the cell. Otherwise, it wouldn't be isotonic. Is that all clear? So that's what that question amounts to doing, exactly what I just showed you, which requires you to have data properly plotted, properly spaced, properly line fitted, so that you can properly do that interpolation. In other words, it's the answer to the question of what is the concentration inside the cell is the x value at the point where the line of best fit crosses the zero x-axis. All right? So you're going to remember to do that way. Later on, when you finally get around to writing this report, remember that this recording exists. And listen to it. Don't just read the instructions in the manual. Listen to the recording, as you should each week anyway. Okay, now how much time did I consume? More than you're even supposed to wait? Okay, so there's nothing magic about 30 minutes or whatever it told you to wait. you're just ready to go now. So get your final measurements and clean up.